this one. Okay, we are in 2 Corinthians, and we're in chapter 5. And I told you I was going to go back to that this week and finish up chapter 5 because I believe the thought begins there. And so in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 20, that's where we're going to begin our study. As I thought about this section, it made me think about a time when I was a little kid, and we used to have this steep hill that was right outside of our house in the front, the street that ran right down in front of our house. And we used to have these skateboards. Ripsticks are the fad today, but we had skateboards. And we could really fly down that hill. The problem was, at the bottom of the hill, there was another road that crossed it, and you couldn't see the cars coming around the corner the other way. But you know, you're 14, 13, you don't worry about those kind of things. You just skate. And I remember coming down the hill one day and my mom screaming at me coming out the house to get off of that skateboard because she could see what I couldn't see coming. And I don't think it was near as hazardous as what she thought it was. But that didn't matter. She thought it was. And she didn't care if everybody in the planet heard her yelling at me. It wasn't embarrassing to her, it may have been to me, but she was concerned about my well-being. She wanted me off that skateboard. And you might have had some type of encounters like that yourself, if you're mothers and kids. And I know sometimes at a store, you might have a child who wanders down the aisle and gets a little bit farther than a mother feels as comfortable before she disappears around the corner. You'll hear this voice of authority crying out for her to get back over here right now. And usually there's a strength in that voice, and there's also a sense of fear because they're worried about the well-being of that child. In Corinth, these Christians were in danger. And they were in danger of falling away. And Paul is crying out to them in this chapter. And this is a good lesson, I think, for us on how to appeal to people who are moving away from Christ, who are going away. And it's also lessons for us when we begin to move away, if we are the ones who are moving away from Christ on both sides of the picture. But I like to see this as, and think about this as, Paul opening up his heart to draw these people back to God. So let's read this first segment here in verse 20 all the way down through chapter 6 and verse 2. Listen to some of the things he says. He says, as ambassadors for Christ, as though God were pleading by us, we implore you in Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. You know, we usually point out here and like to point out that when the apostles say something, we need to take it seriously because they are Christ's ambassadors speaking on his behalf. And that is true. Jesus said, those who hear you, hear me. And those who reject you, reject me. And those who reject me, reject my Father. And so we emphasize, listen to the apostles. They are crying out. But you know what he's doing here? He is crying out to these people. Be reconciled to God. Something is wrong. There is a rift in the relationship between these Corinthians and God. And he is calling them to be reconciled to God. And he goes on in verse chapter 6 and verse 1. He said, then we as fellow workers. Now he didn't call himself ambassadors here, but as workers together with God, plead with you also that you not receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, I have heard you in an acceptable time, and in the day of salvation I have helped you. Behold, now is the day of salvation. Now is the acceptable time. Do you hear his voice of urgency in that? Do you hear a mother pleading, crying out to these people? He says, don't receive the grace of God in vain. He is appealing to them because he's worried about them. And the first way that he appeals to them, when he calls them back to be reconciled to God, is he appeals to them on the basis of what God did for them. Verse 21 of chapter 5, he says, for he has made him who knew no sin to be sin on your behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. There's nothing more powerful, there's no more powerful way to try to draw people back to God than to appeal to them on the basis of what His Son has done for them, what Christ has done, that God has made His Son sin for us. The last chapter, he said, Christ's love compels us. And it's going to have to be Christ's love that compels us to come back when we're starting to drift away. And that's how Paul appeals to them. I think it's interesting that he's not too proud to beg, is he? He says, we beg you, we urge you to be reconciled. This is an invitation for Christians. You know, we teach, and I think rightly so, against the doctrine that once saved, always saved. I don't think that's true. But sometimes we live like we believe that. And these Christians are living as though they think that all is fine between them and God. It's an invitation for them. Don't make God's grace empty. There's a sense of urgency here too, isn't there? He said that God listened to them. He heard them in an acceptable time. And in the day of salvation, He helped them. He did that in the past. But that day has come again. Now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. They need to be saved again. There is a problem. And they're moving away. Sometimes I think we presume upon God's grace as though it's always available for our convenience. You hear what I'm saying? Sometimes we presume that God's grace is always there to rescue us at our convenience, that we can drift away, we can live like the world, we can move away from Him, and He's just going to sit around and wait till it's our... And have that grace held out there so whenever we're good and ready, we can come back and He's obligated to give it to us. Paul is saying now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. That window may not be open when we are good and ready to come back to God. We better take advantage of our opportunity when it's extended to us. And Paul is calling to these people and urging them to act upon this appeal right now. But he appeals to them not only on the basis of what God has done to them through His Son, but also He appeals to them through His own character. Verse 3, He said, we give no offense in anything that our ministry not be blamed, but in all things we commend ourselves as ministers of God. The strength of Paul's appeal to them, first of all, is on the basis of the love that God had extended to them and His Son. But another strong point of his appeal to them is the kind of character that he's demonstrated and his integrity as he's worked among them. He's behaved admirably among these Christians so that his work and his ministry may not be maligned. There's a lot of accusations being leveled against Paul that he has to address in this letter. But he is still able to appeal to these Corinthians to come back by his godly character. Can we do that? When we want to reach out to someone who's moving away, can we appeal to them and expect our character to stand as a testimony to help draw them back? My point is, our effort to call people to come to Christ who are not Christians isn't very powerful if our character is not that of Christ's. Likewise, if we're trying to draw someone back to Christ who's going away, who is a Christian, our appeal is about only as strong as the character that we have. If we don't behave like Christians, we're going to have a hard time drawing people back who are moving away from Christ. And Paul is not bragging about himself when he says he commends himself to them. But he was always conscientious to have a good character so it would not hinder him from being able to reach out to people. Whether he's reaching out to the church or he's reaching out to the world, his character was admirable and respectable, and it would not get in the way of the appeal of the gospel to draw people back. We just need to have a good character. We need to be like Christ if we want people to be drawn back when we go after them. But there's another thing here that I think is really powerful, and that his appeal to them is that based on his loving service to them. Do you know why God can appeal to us and touch our hearts? Because he can point to the sacrifice that he made for us. And he can demonstrate his love for us by his giving and how he's denied himself. And he can show his love is apparent. And so it has a drawing power. Paul can say the same thing. He can use that too to reach out to these Corinthians. He says to them, beginning in verse 4, "But in all things we commend ourselves as ministers," or if you have a New American Standard, "as servants of God." He's not saying as preachers of God. He's appealing to them as servants of God. "In much patience, in tribulation, in needs, and in distresses." But you know, Paul didn't look too good on paper. These teachers in Corinth, these false teachers, they looked good on paper. They had letters of recommendation. They looked sharp. They probably were eloquent. They had this kind of resume. Paul didn't have that kind of... He didn't look good on paper. But that's not how he appealed to these Corinthians. His love for them was based on his sacrifice for them. And the strength of his appeal to them to draw them back is based on his personal sacrifice for them. Look at the circumstances that he faced for them. The afflictions, the hardships, the distresses. You know what that says? It says love. It cries out love. He says, more than that, in stripes and imprisonments and in riots or tumults. Those are sufferings that he endured at the hands of other people. Beatings, imprisonments, riots. What does that say? It says he loves them. He talks about other sufferings. He says, in labors or hard work, verse 5, in sleeplessness, in fastings. Those are voluntary sufferings. Those are not ones forced upon Paul, but those are ones that he imposed upon himself for the sake of other people. That says love. These false teachers have resumes. They looked impressive on paper. But whose resume looked better? I doubt that they could boast of these things. Any sacrifice for these Corinthians. He talks about four qualities that characterized him, that should characterize all of us. Verse 6, he says, "By purity, by knowledge, by long-suffering, by kindness." Here are qualities that Paul demonstrated and exercised as he worked with these Corinthians. I'm not going to read it, but a great extrapolation on that, or more information, if you looked in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, as Paul talked about his giving himself for the Thessalonians. It's the same idea. He worked with them with purity, with knowledge, with long-suffering or patience, and with kindness. And then notice, I think, the source of his strength. He says, by the Holy Spirit, by unfeigned love, by the word of truth, by the power of God. This is Paul's source of strength as he reached out to these and did his work among these people. It was not strength within himself. In fact, earlier in the letter he says, we were not adequate within ourselves. He had to trust in someone other than himself. And then he goes on and he talks about his weapons. He says, by the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left. You know, it's possible that that armor could have been the word of truth. But on the other hand, it could have been his character again, his righteousness, the right conduct that he exercised among those people. But what he didn't have was the weapons of men. He didn't use the kind of weapons that people use. He didn't use techniques like high pressure techniques. He didn't use the weapons that these false teachers were using to try to pressure the Corinthians to do what they wanted them to do. He appealed to them with the weapons of righteousness. And he'll talk about that more when we get to chapter 10. There's some good lessons in this. Just this idea that Paul's appeal was based on the love that he had for these people. And he had demonstrated in the past. You know, the lessons for us is that the drawing power of our pleas to people is equal to the sacrifice that we've made for them in the past. The drawing power of our pleas to people to bring them back is equal to the degree of our sacrifice for them in the past. The elder that doesn't lay his life down for a person will not have much effect on helping them when they're hurting. The evangelist who does not impart his own life, as Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 2, who doesn't impart his own life for people, in addition to preaching the gospel to a congregation won't get many people to listen to him. A brother or a sister who sacrificially serves one another and shows genuine interest and time and blood, sweat, and tears for individuals, that person is going to be more effective in winning someone back when they begin to move away. Amen? The two greatest commandments is love God and love your neighbor. I really believe, as I look through 2 Corinthians, that this letter, at least for me, illustrates perhaps as much or more than any other of the letters, really love worked out in a practical way, as it's demonstrated between Paul and this group of Christians. I look at the Samaritan sometime in Jesus' parable, and I ask myself, you know, about the degree to which I imitate that Samaritan. Because that's a servant of God. That's someone who's shown the true love. Jesus used him as an illustration for that lawyer that day. Paul demonstrates that. He fights the battle again. But look, I want you to notice how Paul might have appeared as opposed to what the reality was. Look, if you would, again, down in verse 8. He says, by honor and dishonor, by evil report and good report, as deceivers and yet true, as unknown and yet well known, as dying and behold we live, as chastened or disciplined and yet not killed, as sorrowful and yet always rejoicing, as poor and yet making many rich, as having nothing and yet possessing all things. These are contrasts. I think it's how things appeared, how Paul might have looked, and yet the reality of how things really were. And it teaches, I think, you know, these Corinthians, these teachers, these false teachers that had come to Corinth used things to discredit Paul before others. But they were not the reality. Paul may have looked, he may have been treated with dishonor. There may have been evil reports about him. He may have been accused of being a deceiver. He may have looked like he was being chastened or disciplined. He may have been poor, and I think likely he was very poor physically and materially. And it may have looked like he had nothing, but that was not really the reality. But sometimes when we have carnal eyes, if we are like the Corinthians and we have a carnal mindset, if we looked at Paul, we would think those things about him. We would believe those kind of accusations. But that was the fault of the Corinthians. That wasn't the reality. Paul, it said, was very honorable. There was a good report about him from the Lord. He was true. He may have been poor, but he was busy making many rich. So I kind of see this as a difference in how things appeared versus the reality of how things really were. And how you see it depends on what kind of mind you have. Whether you have a carnal mind or whether you have a spiritual mind. The lessons, I think, are that really, it's really tempting sometimes if you're someone named Paul, if you're a servant of God, to try to maintain an appearance that the world would be impressed with. It's easy to feel that if we don't have the things that impress people, that we won't be taken seriously, that people won't listen to us. It's possible to think that we're going to draw people to Christ the same way as these false teachers did. And if we don't have these things, it won't work. Paul didn't look impressive. He would look anything but impressive. Jesus did not work to maintain external facade. The Pharisees did that. Paul didn't do that, and Jesus didn't either. Everything Paul did, the care he took with his ministry, the personal sacrifices he made, the humiliation he accepted, they all attest to his love for them. His love for God, his love for people, and I think he raises the bar for us. He really does. That love is what counts, and that people respond to love. He appeals to them also. He calls them to open their hearts to him. Verse 11, look at that. He says, O Corinthians, we have spoken openly to you. Our heart is wide open. You're not restricted by us, but you are restricted in your own affections. The first thing Paul does, he wants to be reconciled to these Corinthians. He would like to be reconciled to them. But he first exposes his own heart. He says, "Oh, Corinthians." That's kind of like Jesus when he said, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who stones the prophets." He said, "How often we wanted to gather you together." It's this emotional, passionate, heartfelt appeal to these people. And he did it first. That's what I want you to see. We want other people to expose their hearts. We want them to come forward. We want them to straighten out. But we have to appeal to them first. God took the initiative. He poured out His love first for us. And we have to pour out our love for others first before they're going to respond to us. It says that they claim, this is possible here when he said, "You are not restricted by us." It's possible that they claimed that Paul had restricted them. Maybe they acted like victims and said, "You know, Paul, we'd love to open up to you. We'd sure like to do that. But you know, you've just been so hard on us. You know, you've just caused us so much grief by writing these mean letters to us, by telling us what we ought to do. Why, you've just closed us off. We can't respond to you." But that wasn't the case. The truth is, it wasn't Paul that didn't love them enough. It's not Paul that had restricted them, but it was their own affections. And their affections were not toward God, but they were toward the world. Look at that again. "You are not restricted by us, but you are restricted by your own affections. Now in return for the same, I speak as to children, you be open." Open yourself up to us. The thing is, they love the world too much. That's why they couldn't respond. And so he talks to them in verse 14 through 17 about their affections toward things that were worldly. He says to them, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has he who believes with an unbeliever?" They were unequally yoked with unbelievers. He is concerned because they are somehow connected with darkness. There is darkness in their lives. Obviously, the yoke together, we know that it's when two different kind of animals are harnessed together, two that don't match. Put an ox and a donkey together, they're not going to work well together. They don't fit. Well, these Corinthians had yoked themselves in some way to something that was completely the opposite of them. What unbelievers is he talking about here? I don't know absolutely, but I would suggest to you the first application is most likely these false teachers. They've invited them in. They've welcomed them. They're listening to them. Perhaps they're already following some of their teachings about keeping the old covenant. But they've let them in and they've given them their greetings. It's possible this is a really good illustration of that passage that we read in 2 Peter, when he gets on to people for going outside of the doctrine of Christ. And he said to them, "If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house or greet him. For he who greets him shares in his evil deeds." Is it possible that's where what he's talking about here? They're sharing with these false teachers. We can do this too, where we want to have one foot in the world and the other foot in the church. We want to have one foot in the world and also another foot in with Christ. I want to be okay with God, but I still want to go out and drink with my coworkers after work. You know, I want to be okay with God, but I still want to sleep with my boyfriend. I want to be okay with God and be right with Him, but I still want to be tolerant of people in the church who need discipline. Remember, that was a problem back in 1 Corinthians 5. They were too tolerant of wickedness. I want to be okay with God and still go to the idol's temple. He makes that point in 1 Corinthians 2. He says in chapter 10, you can't sit at the table of demons and at the table of the Lord. You can't do that. They're two completely different things. The Corinthians were affectionate, all right, but their affections were too drawn to worldliness. They tried to accept lawlessness and righteousness and darkness and light and let them dwell together. He says to them in verse 16 to 18, he talks to them and he talks to us. And we need to see ourselves just as he was describing them. He says, "What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God." And as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I'll be their God, and they'll be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. And do not touch what is unclean, and I'll receive them. Wow, there's no greater privilege than to imagine that we're the temple of God, and that God wants to dwell in us and walk among us. But he says, for me to do that, you have to be clean. You have to be separate yourselves from things that are dark. We don't have time to do it. We will in a few weeks. But I'm going to go to a Leviticus son this year, and I want you to see what holiness is and the degree to which God expects us to do some separating from things that are unclean. Does God's grace tolerate us touching worldly things and us not be contaminated? Can we do that? Can we participate and share in worldliness and not be contaminated before the Lord? Can God live with us while we touch wickedness and sit with it and enjoy it? Are we not becoming polluted by these things? What I'm going to be calling for you to do this year is to raise your level of sensitivity to that. Most of us have a conscience about staying away from darkness. Most of us have a conscience. But we need to ask ourselves where we're at. Do we feel good about it when we're 50% separated from wickedness? We feel pretty good. Do we feel, you know, when you're a new Christian, that may be where you're at when you're first baptized. But I think God expects us as we grow and mature to perfect holiness. We haven't got to that verse yet, but in chapter 7 and verse 1, let's go ahead and read that. He says, therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. We've got to see where we are, and we've got to honestly and objectively look at how much we work to separate ourselves from things that God would consider unclean. And we need to raise the bar, and we need to move to a higher level than that. We need to take our consciences and be more sensitive than we are now at the kind of things that we participate in and feed into our minds. He says, separate. He says, cleanse yourselves from all filthiness. That's pretty inclusive, isn't it? Of the flesh and the spirit. It's easier to cleanse ourselves from the flesh than it is the spirit. We may say I gave up drinking, and I gave up smoking, and I gave up immoral actions, behavior. I'm not sleeping with anybody. Well, the Pharisees could probably boast that. Guys, don't pat yourself on the back because that's all that you've done. The Pharisees could boast that. He said, if you can't do any better than the Pharisees, then you can't be a part of my kingdom. God raises the bar for us. And he says, you need to be perfected in flesh and spirit. We need to go further maybe than where we're at. So I'm challenging you this year to think about that. He says to them, he calls for a separation. He calls for a separation. He says in verse 17, therefore, come out from among them and be separate. And he's speaking to these Corinthians of what they needed to do. There was a practical application of this church in their day. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. There's some great blessings that we don't want to overlook. That he promises God's presence. Verse 16, I will walk among you. I will dwell with you. He promises that he will welcome them. Verse 17, come out from among them, be separate. I will receive you. And he promises to be a father to them. In verse 18, I will be a father to you, and you will be sons and daughters to me. Therefore, having these promises, we've got to value those things. We've got to value those promises. If we will value those promises, then he said he will dwell with us. Perfect holiness, he says. Perfect holiness in verse 1 of chapter 7. In the fear of God. You know, chapter 5 and verse 10, he said, every one of us, he says, we have to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an answer for all that we do in our bodies. Therefore, he said, we fear God. He preached to them the fear of God, because we have to stand before Him and give an answer. That needs, there is a sense of motivation in that, to perfect holiness before we have to stand before Him. He concludes His appeal to them in chapter 7, verse 2 through 4. He says, "Open your hearts to us." Kind of comes back to the way He began it, doesn't He? Open your hearts to us. We've wronged no one, we've corrupted no one, we have defrauded no one. I do not say this to condemn you, for I have said before to you that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. You know, it's kind of a great invitation, isn't it? To be reconciled to God, the first one, back in the end of chapter 5. And to be reconciled to us. Open your hearts here. Let us in. You've closed us out. He's saying, open your hearts and let us back in. Paul hasn't abused them like these false teachers have. He's only reached out to them in love. And he hasn't given up on them. It's amazing how Paul can come back around to exhortation. He can warn them and he can address them strongly and call them to come back. But then he can even conclude it with a word of exhortation. He says, "I do not say this to condemn you, for I have said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. Great is my boldness of speech towards you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. I'm exceedingly joyful in all of our tribulation." Well, I'm stopping there because we're out of time. But the good news, there's really a lot of good news here. The next verses is going to tell you why he was so excited about them. Because they had responded well to the letter that he had sent them. But you have to wait until next week to hear that. But the invitation is not to non-Christians today. It's really to Christians, if we like this chapter, invite us. That we need to be reconciled to God. Because he has made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. If you need to be reconciled to God today, we would invite you to make that decision as together we stand and sing.